Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vagha Mradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Last week, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo brokered the fourth and latest ceasefire between Armenia and Azerbaijan that was violated soon after it was inked. Intense fighting has raged between Armenian and combined Turkish and Azerbaijani forces seeking to take control of the Armenian enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh that's been autonomous since the early 1990s after the dissolution of the Soviet Union. The territory is formally part of Azerbaijan, but the area has been historically and ethnically Armenian. The conflict has been brutal and served as a laboratory for high-end unmanned systems, as well as powerful jamming technologies. While the Armenian army is considered among the best in the region, it has lost ground to Turkish unmanned systems like the Bayraktar and the Israeli Harop and other loitering systems Jerusalem has sold to Baku over the past decade. Turkey also has imported thousands of Syrians to fight on Azerbaijan's behalf. Although Russia has publicly remained on the sidelines, news reports suggest that Moscow, which has a base in Armenia, has deployed powerful jamming systems against the Turkish and Azeri systems. Joining us today to discuss the military takeaways from this conflict is one of the world's leading experts on the Russian military and its unmanned systems, Sam Bendett of the Center for Naval Analyses. He's also a fellow at the Center for a New American Security. Sam, thanks very much for joining us.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me again on your show.
It's always an honor and pleasure, Sam, especially when we're talking about something that involves the words Russia and unmanned systems and laboratory. But before we get started, I just wanted to give a shout out to all of our sponsors. Our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Bell, Beretta USA and Leonardo DRS all sponsored our coverage of AUSA Now, the Association of the United States Army's virtual annual meeting. Complicated conflict, obviously, Sam. There were a lot of folks who've been looking at when Russia was going to play a more prominent role. There were multiple ceasefires. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, as I mentioned, brokered the latest ceasefire. But what we're interested in is how these unmanned systems, loitering unmanned systems, whether they're unmanned systems that Turkey has deployed to the area, or whether or not the variety of unmanned systems that the Azeris have acquired from Israel are playing into this conflict. And then, of course, Russia's apparent, right? The news reports that Russians are deploying their very powerful jamming systems that we've discussed in the past. From your standpoint, what are the key takeaways from this conflict?
So the key takeaway is if you're going to fight a war right now, basically in 2020, you have to have unmanned systems. It is not just a requirement, it is simply a must. And as you've mentioned earlier, Azeri initiatives have been able to reverse Armenia's high quality ground forces and the progress they have made since 1992. But the real question is, who was preparing better for this upcoming conflict? And Azerbaijan over the past decade has realized that in order to fight in a very difficult mountainous terrain that is Nagorno-Karabakh, that is Armenia and Azerbaijan, you need to have a very specific ISR, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance advantage that could be matched to a kinetic force, presumably another unmanned system, so that you don't have to deploy manned aerial assets, which are few and are quite expensive, such as aircraft and helicopters. And so Azerbaijan has acquired a number of UAVs from Israel and recently from Turkey. It has loitering munitions, the Israeli Harop, Israeli Striker, and the Orbiter loitering drone. It has multiple ISR drones. It has Israeli Hermes, Israeli Heron, Israeli Searcher, Aerostar drone, and multiple Orbiter drones that supply information anywhere within a radius of a few kilometers to several tens of kilometers and even longer. But of course, the real sort of attention grabber has been the deployment of Turkish unmanned combat vehicle, the Bayraktar, the same UAV used by Turkish forces in Syria and in Libya. There are also reports of Turkish loitering quadricopters, the Kargu, that have also been deployed by the Azeri forces. So Azerbaijan has a veritable zoo of UAVs and drones that it can use for intelligence and for striking targets. It is curious at this point and rather puzzling that Armenia hasn't ramped up its own drone acquisition over the past decades, as it saw, and I'm sure as it was able to observe, Azerbaijan publicly acquiring Israeli and Turkish technology.
I mean, so what Azerbaijan has effectively done is created a reconnaissance strike complex, to use a very Russian term. Talk to us about how each of these pieces come together to create really compressed kill chains in a way that has been surprising, not just on the Armenian side, but also on the Azeri side, how economically now force can be projected.
So let's take a step back. Even as drones can strike targets, or even as Azerbaijani drones can successfully take out Armenian ground vehicles and air defenses and other assets, drones don't really hold territory. So the maps that show Azeri acquisition of Nagorno-Karabakh territory bit by bit is actually a reflection of Azerbaijani ground forces still having to take positions and hold specific territory as they advance 1 square kilometer by square kilometer and encircle Nagorno-Karabakh enclave. But the drones, what they were able to do is successfully take out artillery, air defenses, radars, and of course, ground assets like tanks and armored vehicles of all kinds. They were able to conduct assassination strikes. And so loitering munitions were launched to look for targets. ISR drones were essentially taken to the air to provide precise data and geolocation of targets for manned assets like aircraft, for land-based artillery multiple launch rocket systems, as well as for companion drones like the Bayraktar. So oftentimes, a target that was shown on a video was actually sighted by one of the smaller Israeli ISR drones that I listed, like an Aerostar or an Orbiter, or maybe by a larger one like a Hermes or Heron. And then information was passed to Bayraktar that then was able to strike the target. Sometimes that information was even passed to Kargu, combat loitering quadricopters that were able to fly into the targets once those targets were identified. But again, just taking out targets wasn't enough. Azerbaijani forces still had to take and hold land. And this grueling contest that is displayed in maps that are updated on a daily basis is a reflection, if of Azeri success, then of the fact that they were able to conduct an attrition campaign against a limited number of Armenian assets. But the infantry still had to take the villages and the towns and other locations.
Let me ask about Russia's role. What has been Russia's role so far? What do we know, especially about the jamming systems that Russia has used, that it has invested in considerably to be able to dominate the electronic battle space, electromagnetic battle space?
Well, we know that there's a Russian base in Armenia. We know that Russian and Armenian forces have trained together multiple occasions. This past year, actually, Russian and Armenian UAV operators also trained together at that base and other locations across Armenia. But what we also know is that every significant Russian military base, whether it's in the former Soviet Union or abroad, like in Syria, has layered protection, meaning it has electronic warfare, it has aircraft defense, anti-aircraft defenses, and air defenses of all kinds, as well as early warning radars. So the Russian base in Armenia would have, by design, an electronic warfare defense mechanism. And open source reports indicate that one of those electronic warfare systems is the Krasukha. The Krasukha 4 is a large, powerful electronic warfare system that has been used in Syria against drone strikes and in the defense of Russian ground assets in Syria altogether. And so it is surprising that Russian involvement hasn't been more forceful, hasn't been more direct in defense of Armenia, considering the fact that nations enjoy a special military relationship, a military pact, and again, a special political and economic relationship within the former Soviet space. It is unclear if the Russian involvement will increase. It is unclear if the Russians will overtly come to the aid of Armenians. But again, open source reports indicate to electronic warfare components, as well as to forward operating contingents within Armenia on the Armenian Nagorno-Karabakh border. So it's interesting to see how Russia, which I'm sure Armenia looked forward to providing greater protection, will act from this point on.
And talk to us about some of the features of those jamming systems. How much of it is jamming? How much of it is spoofing? Walk us through the capabilities of that system.
Well, multiple Russian electronic warfare systems are designed to scramble signals. And so Krasukha and other companion systems like Moskva are basically designed to first identify and then scramble the onboard communications of aerial targets. A lot of those electronic warfare systems are actually designed to operate against aircraft, but they may work against the drones just as well. Of course, the ultimate goal for electronic warfare system that is designed to combat drones is to disrupt the signal between the operating base and the drones themselves, assuming that the drones have to rely on a ground command and control for guidance and for further activity. So that is how these Russian electronic warfare systems were able to combat some of the simpler drones that were targeting Russian bases in Syria. A lot of these were kind of DIY drones. They didn't feature a lot of sophisticated equipment. Of course, Israeli and Turkish drones are a lot more sophisticated, but they too can be taken out by electronic warfare and by air defenses. For example, we have evidence of Iranian border forces shooting down some of the Israeli and Turkish-made drones launched by Azerbaijan that strayed into their territory because Iran is right there, right next to Armenia and Azerbaijan. So EW systems can be very successful if used correctly with, or rather in concert, or as Russians define it, as a layered defense with early warning radars and various kinetic systems to take the drones out of the sky.
And do we have any evidence whether or not the Russians have been successful in taking out Turkish and Israeli drones?
Well, I don't have that evidence. I've been looking at open sources. Of course, this whole conflict is such a moving target. By the time we may finish talking, right, new information may come to light. But we haven't seen direct evidence of Russian systems taken out Azeri drones made in Israel and Turkey. But we do have evidence of Armenian forces themselves shooting some of these drones out of the sky.
Let me ask about Russia's arsenal and what Russia has in its arsenal that is similar to what the Israelis and the Turks have been using. Russians have been leading thinkers, leading military thinkers always. And you and I have been talking about, you know, everything from Ochotnik to a whole bunch of other land and air-based systems. But what do you think some of the lessons that Russia is drawing as it looks at how these systems are being used and its own arsenal and how it plans to use them?
Well, lesson number one here is thinking through a problem isn't enough. You have to do something about it. And we have talked a lot, and Russian commentators themselves have been very open, and even the military establishment has been relatively open in admitting that Russian defense industry in general has been late to the game when it comes to combat UAVs and combat drones. In fact, this week, Russia acquired its first unit of combat drones. It acquired three Orion UAVs that were tested in Syria last year with live munitions. So these three UAVs are the only real combat drones that Russia has. In the meantime, other countries like Turkey, Iran, obviously United States, Israel, and China have these unmanned combat aerial vehicles, or UCAVs, by the many hundreds. Russia also just started designing and testing loitering munitions. One such munition made news, made by Kalashnikov. Of course, the global sort of defense analysis community wanted to kind of characterize it as the Kalashnikov of loitering munitions. But again, Russia has a very limited number of such loitering munitions, and it is only now starting to ramp up the production and testing. So unfortunately for Armenia, Russia really didn't have a lot to offer it. And presumably, given a close relationship between Russia and Armenia, if Russian military had several types of combat drones that it could offer for export, Armenia probably would have acquired them. But again, the issue here is that Russia right now has very little to offer Armenia when it comes to combat UAVs and loitering munitions. Armenia may have turned to other international exporters of such systems, maybe China, maybe others, but for some reason, it didn't. Armenia has its own drone production, but it is very limited, and most of their drones are actually ISR. It is only now starting to design and field a loitering drone. In fact, there's open source videos of that test. But again, it's kind of late to the game when Azerbaijan has an entire collection of different ranged systems that it can use. So the lesson here is you need those systems yesterday. And of course, the major lesson is a country such as, for example, Russia, a country such as Armenia, Russia because it considers itself a global military power, Armenia because it was locked in essentially unfinished war with Azerbaijan, they had to look at how other countries were building and designing such system. And of course, it wasn't just advanced nations like United States or UK or even nations that were pioneers with modern drones like Israel. When other nations started getting into the drone business, Iran, China, Turkey, other countries, the real lesson is if so many states are moving towards utilization of these new systems, then Russia surely has had to do the same. And there's a lot of discussions within Russia right now why that wasn't done, why it had different priorities, and how it kind of rushed into the drone race that it is essentially engaged in right now. For a country like Armenia, again, for someone like myself who is an observer of how this technology is developed and fielded, it's puzzling that Armenia, while seeing how Azerbaijan starts acquiring different types of military purpose drones, why it also didn't launch its own major acquisition drive to sort of try and match Azerbaijani capabilities. I think this conflict would have been different if Armenia also possessed a large number of ISR loitering munition drones, as well as some combat UAVs. But alas, we find ourselves right now in October 2020 talking about Azerbaijan essentially degrading to a very significant extent Nagorno-Karabakh and some of the Armenian defenses.
Let me ask, and of course, right, I mean, one of the transshipment issues is Georgia controls airspace adjacent to Armenia, Turkey controls airspace, Azerbaijan controls airspace. So really, the only corridor is in through Iran, which shares a very small border with Armenia, right? So from a resupply standpoint, it becomes a little bit problematic if it's any flight that's not sort of a scheduled commercial or cargo flight. What are things that small countries like Armenia can do to, right? I mean, how easy is it to develop this capability indigenously at this point, right? Because Sam, you mentioned countries all around the world are developing and have been investing in this capability. I mean, I remember 10, 12 years ago, whether you went to the Emirates or even Jordan, right? I mean, countries that at the time you would not think of as sort of, you know, being on the cutting edge of military capability were already working and developing things of some degree of sophistication. In this day and age, how easy is it to establish the kind of industry that can produce competitive products indigenously?
Let me rephrase that. I wouldn't use the word easy because easy implies you have plenty of resources, financial and otherwise, and forward-looking military staff and a political leadership that understands how future wars are fought. I would use the word possible. How possible is it for a small country to develop this capability? And I would say that at this point in time, in October 2020, I think it is very possible. You have a lot of nations that are exporting such capabilities. Technology for indigenous production has also become very widespread. Such drones need not be very sophisticated. But again, what is needed are appropriate resources allocated to the development and the testing and evaluation and eventual fielding of such weapons. This is where some of the sort of Russian commentators are really lamenting about the 1990s and the early 2000s when they had different priorities and the military looked at sort of different capabilities for the Russian armed forces instead of also looking at how drones can help. So for a nation like Armenia, again, Armenia finds itself in a very precarious situation. My understanding is Armenia is now looking for imports. It is engaging different players and trying to bolster its own capability. But it is possible for a small nation right now to strike a bargain and import this technology. Again, the number of exporters of this technology is growing rapidly. And it now includes China, which is willing to export this technology all over the world. And some of the players that used to be minor in military production but have since really moved to the front, such as Iran and Turkey and some European nations.
One last question. So if you were the one who was sitting in the Armenian Defense Ministry in Yerevan, you would have not invested the $100 million on four Sukhois. You would have invested that $100 million in drones.
Well, I'm not an Armenian defense official, and I don't know how they were defining their priorities. We can only kind of look at this in hindsight. And of course, hindsight is always 2020, and we can always make accurate assessment in hindsight. But again, to me, it seems rather puzzling that Armenia must have known how Azerbaijan was acquiring different drone capabilities, because a lot of these acquisitions were rather public. They were public releases, et cetera. So why didn't it try to sort of match some of that acquisition? Why didn't it sort of ring alarm that Azerbaijan may have some kind of advantage? Again, to me, it's unclear. I think what we're seeing here is the final thawing out of frozen conflicts, right? Because at the collapse of the former Soviet Union between 1992 to 1994, a lot of these conflicts were frozen by 1994. And some have become hot since, like in 2008, the conflict between Georgia and South Ossetia, as well as some of the sort of relationship between Georgia and Abkhazia. That conflict has begun more or less to resolve itself in, for example, Russia's favor or in favor of these breakaway states. Nagorno-Karabakh was a frozen conflict for almost 20 years at this point, right? Maybe Armenian defense officials were thinking that it would never come to actual war, that Armenia's relationship with Russia would sort of shield Armenia and Nagorno-Karabakh from an actual war with neighboring Azerbaijan. But again, I'm not an Armenian official. I don't know what they were prioritizing. Right. There are other smaller frozen conflicts in the former Soviet space. One of them is the, for example, Transnistria region in Moldova. And the question is, will that conflict also go hot? And of course, when such conflicts flare up again, they sort of reach this sort of level of viciousness and inability of both sides to really come to an agreement that is truly unfortunate. But Nagorno-Karabakh is a very different conflict. And it goes to the core of the priorities between Armenia and Azerbaijan and what they're willing to sort of cooperate on or negotiate on. And we know that they're talking to the Russians. Both belligerents are talking to the Russians. They're talking to the Americans. And the question is, okay, now that this conflict has gone hot, now that one side is gaining an advantage, what is the next step?
Generally, the side that has the advantage feels less compelled to negotiate than the side that doesn't. I think the dynamic that was game-changing here also, Sam, was Turkey's direct involvement in it. I think that in most of these scenarios, nobody expected Ankara to be pushing Baku for action and then meticulously pre-planning military exercises, leaving jets behind. So the degree of sort of coordination and joint planning, and again, I mean, the introduction of Syrian fighters recruited from Syria and transshipped to Azerbaijan to be sort of the frontline cannon fodder, if you will, was also something that was unanticipated. So, I mean, the conflict has an enormous number of very, very interesting factors for observers around the world. Thanks so very much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Any other last thoughts?
Well, I think going back to your comment about a small country's capabilities going forward, I think we are long past the point where such drone warfare was considered sort of the purview of richer, wealthier nations that could afford to expand them on the battlefield. I think loitering munitions and ISR drones and even some combat UAVs have shown that they could be cheap, they could be numerous, and that they could be acquirable, if you will, by small nations with small budgets. So I think going forward, we will unfortunately see a lot more UAVs used in conflicts of all kinds, different kinds of UAVs used with and in concert with ground forces and air defenses and manned aviation. So I think we're now at a point where a combat drone and an ISR drone is really a regular tool of warfare, not just for wealthy nations, but even for smaller nations going forward.
Sam, thanks very much. We would like to point out to our audience that Azerbaijan is an oil-producing nation, so a lot of that wealth was channeled in to this capability for a decade, even if oil prices are weak now. But the point is a well-taken one. Thanks so much again. Always a pleasure having you on, Sam.
Thank you.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.